free dancing lessons to the jitterbug rag. Ain't no shortcuts in the dress and drag. Only a fool in here thinks he's got anything to do. Not a war on the bridge, not out of step two. Gentlemen, I'm only passing through. People are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked in tight, my brain used to care, but things have changed. Back road, the Bible is right, the world would explode. I've been trying to get as far away from myself as I can. Something too hard to touch, but you and I can only stand so much. You can't win, you're losing. Feel like falling in love with the first one. Putting in a wheel out of our hand, moving her down the street. You run crazy. I'm in hiding, my rain.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona Land, 15 October 2018, Monday. Your mind's primary weapon. You've tuned into Liberty Tree Radio. It's about 4 minutes after 8 a.m. Oh, man. We'll get back to our lesson about guerrilla warfare. Thanks for taking the time to tune in today. And thank you for Liberty Tree Radio for giving us this opportunity. We're in the last 6 months of the year, ladies and gentlemen, and you know the drill. We always try to raise some funds to try to get the bill paid for next year, and we can make a big savings. So please contribute to Liberty Tree Radio. And I think their email address or their websites like libertytreeradio.4mg.com. You've heard it all before. And let's see what else. And the contact information is there. And you can, the mailing address is P.O. Box 194, Dexter, Michigan, 48130, and I guess they got a PayPal, and you can address your check, money order, to Nancy Kornke. And if you, for every dollar you contribute to Liberty Tree Radio, you get your name in the hat for a drawing at the end of the month. And like I say, you've heard it before, but I'm going to say it some more. And, you know, it doesn't seem to be much, but it always seems to be. It takes 10 people that pony up this stuff. But for how many ever people that we have listening, whether they're listening live right now or listening through a micro broadcast or downloading it on the weekend and everything like that, I don't know. I've heard all kinds of estimates on how many people are actually listening. I don't know. Is it 50, 100, 1,000, 10,000? But, you know, if everybody just mail a dollar, well, I can't afford a dollar. Yeah, baloney. You can find that much in pocket change over a year's period in mostly any parking lot in the United States. So don't give me the old I'm on a fixed income and I can't afford it. Have some border news. My email address is altabib762@hotmail.com. Alpha, Lima, Tango, Hotel, Alpha, Bravo, Echo, Bravo, 762@hotmail.com. Sending this one out to Lily, Grace, Antoinette. You know, it's kind of interesting. Picked up a book here, and the... oh, I don't know, Goodwill, something like that, St. Vincent de Paul's. And it's a fairly new book. It's called Not a Good Day to Die. It's called The True Story of Operation Anaconda. This was over in the high mountains in Afghanistan. And it's kind of interesting because it, in a way, it ties in with our lessons about intelligence preparation of the battlefield. I'm going to try not to dwell too long on it, but let's see. Okay, so the special forces are over here training Afghans. They had linked up with the Afghans up in the Panjshir Valley and Ahmad Shah Massoud, and they swept down. All these places just started falling from the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and everybody's on the run. They had Kabul fell, Kandahar, they're taking over, and they were kind of wondering where all these quote-unquote fighters had gone. There was, and then, you know, the attack on Tora Bora, it was kind of going through some of this stuff fairly quickly as a historical perspective, and they had come to the realization that when they attacked Tora Bora, because they had not thought the operation all the way through, that a lot of these people slipped across the border into Pakistan. So this next deal, when the special forces had moved further south, and it's the Shurakut Valley, we're talking, you know, 10,000-15,000 foot mountains, and, you know, little tiny mountains there, like 6,000-7,000 feet. So, and it's straight up and straight down kind of stuff. So anyway, the special forces got these Afghans all trained up, and they were going to come in as a blocking force to keep the escape routes, because they had started getting a lot of intel. CIA was telling them, the people on the ground were telling them, the Afghans were telling them, satellites were telling them that there's a big concentration of these fighters in this one valley. And also there's a lot of operations we're building up around Bagram Air Base, and there's a Gurdes is where the Special Forces safe team house was. And so everything was going fine, well to plan, and then they needed some other people in there. And everybody, this is kind of a big lesson in who's really in charge, and when the things start to kick off, then everybody wants to get a piece of the action, which is unfortunate, because sometimes when you get, as they say, too many cooks spoil the broth. And so anyway, everything gets kicking off here, and the Afghans are in their vehicles. They had made some vehicle recons up to make sure that some of these roads were passable and got up here. And it was at night or early morning, still quite dark, C-130 flying overhead. And something happened with its inertial navigation system, and this happened, and, you know, do you see it coming? Well, all of a sudden, when they had the main convoy was going up this one road to the east of into this valley, and then they're right kind of off to the one side, there was another big peak about 6,000-7,000 feet. They called it the Whale, and this other convoy was going to go up a smaller 4 or 5 vehicles up to this other side to set up all these blocking forces in these suspected retreat routes and through the wadis and the known trails and the gullies and the ditches and the gaps and the gorges and everything like that. So they're blocking all that off. And somehow the inertial navigation got over here. There was a lack of communications between the Air Force and the Special Forces and the Afghans on the ground. And the C-130 flew over, and somewhere along the lines their computer conked out, and they rebooted the computer, and it came back online. And as they came back around, they detected this convoy on the ground, thinking it was a bunch of the enemy Taliban. So they opened fire on that and killed several people and wounded the whole armload. So there goes kind of the Afghan stuff. That did a lot of good for the troop morale and unit cohesion, killed one of the Special Forces leader and several of the Afghans, and now they're having to figure out what they're trying to do. And as they tried to turn around and escape, the C-130s just pouring more and more of these 105 shells in on them, and they're just blowing up their trucks and killing people and scattering their forces and stuff. Needless to say, it leaves a bad taste in the Afghans' mouth. And then anyway, so then in comes the Mountain Division being helicoptered into some of these places, some of them on the valley floor, some of them up. Oh, and prior to that, they had sent in some Delta teams and some SEAL teams up on these ridges, and they snuck in. They had a tryout to see if these people could actually infiltrate the valley without being detected and checking the conditions on the ground. And they were successful after they had gone in there for like a day before this whole operation kicked off, that everything was fine. This is part of your intelligence preparation of the battlefield and your recon to check out the conditions on the ground before you just go stumbling into it. So they pulled those teams out, and then like the next night or two, then they infiltrated the rest of the Delta operators and the SEAL teams, and they had, you know, didn't go flying in on a helicopter, because that was one of the things that the overall commander was a Delta operator in this offshoot. Had nothing to do with Bagram, or they had another place called K2 up in Uzbekistan, and then Mashira, it's an island out in the Persian Gulf. And then, of course, then it's back to Tampa at CENTCOM. And everybody had okayed the plan for this thing ahead of time. And usually, as they say, it's the commander on the ground that knows the situation better. And everything was just fine. These people go in here, and they got dropped off by their helicopters, the Mountain Division, 101st and stuff. And there was a whole lot of other issues of about cap strengths on force and what they can take and what they can't take, and trying to avoid other things and looking like the Afghan or the Soviets trying to take over. It was supposed to be kind of an Afghan thing, so they were going to get the credit of it with a little help from the Americans. And as these recon LPOP teams were starting to be up there for like 2 or 3 days, they had needed to get rotated out. So then here it all comes. Now as this thing's really heating up, then everybody wants to be, I'm the boss, I'm the boss, I'm the boss. And now all of a sudden here they come with the Navy SEAL commander, and he's not actually communicating directly with the Delta Force commander on the ground that has everything in control, running the Special Forces, training the Afghans, calling in these airstrikes. So when these guys pop up with their DSHK machine guns and RPGs and mortars calling in airstrikes, and everybody's holding their own, the casualties are way down, except for the first people that had died on the with the AC-130 air attack. And then all of a sudden now this Navy SEAL commander comes in here and or he's working with somebody else like back at Bagram and K2, and unbeknownst to them, you know, they're using back channels, and then the Delta operator gets this call on his satellite phone or satellite communications and says, well, you know, we're going to be switching some of these people out because they were monitoring some of the transmissions from these LPOPs and decided that they were going to bring in a whole new group of people, strictly Navy SEALs, and they were going to replace these people up in these mountain ridges to be in the LPOPs, and they were asking them, how long is it going to be before you can let these people take over? And, well, and then Special Forces guy, the Delta guy, he comes along and goes, well, you know, I'd like to have them over here for a while. They're going to have to familiarize themselves with the area, need to familiarize themselves with the tactics that are being used. We have a lot of this information. We've studied the history of it, the intelligence preparation of the battlefield, how the enemy attacks, what the enemy's tactics are, what's going to be expected of them when they are attacked. And so the Delta guy asked this new SEAL commander of about when you're going to be able to, you know, get these people up here. And the guy's like, well, I'd like to send them on up there tonight. And it's like, well, you know, it's 10,000 foot mountain, and it's, you know, got hip deep snow up there. These people need to get oriented to what's going on and everything. And then it was a back and forth about, well, how long is it going to be and this and that and blah, blah, blah. And the guy hung up the phone and he wasn't happy with that. So he called the Bagram or K2 and set up this back channel. So they cut the Delta operator out, who was the commander on the ground running the entire operation rather effectively and efficiently, a straight line. Who's in charge? This guy. He makes the decision. It's the commander on the ground that's going to need this and going to need these things. But, oh, well, you see, then when the operation started to really roll along, then everybody wanted to get involved. You had the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines. Everybody wanted to get involved. Funny they didn't bring a Coast Guard cutter in there, too, to get their slice of the pie. So anyway, the Delta operator had a strict rule that there were no going to be any helicopter insertions, because it does no good to do that, because you're giving away, even if you land 10 kilometers away from where you're going to end up, they know you're there. So they had gone in on foot, and they had some super quiet, specially modified ATCs that they had made their way up in some of these back roads and the trails and everything, camouflaged them in the snow, and the blizzard came in and covered up their tracks, and they had been very stealthy and effective in infiltrating there. And then now the back channel operations start going on, and let's see, so they fly, there was a place near where the top of the 10,000-foot mountain was, but on the way up there, the SEAL team commander got with the pilot and says, this is where I want to be set down. Oh, and by the way, yeah, they never even met with these other guys. They went from Bagram and were supposed to stop at Gurdaz and get a briefing on what was going on and the situation on the ground, and they just flew right over it and just kept going. And of course, they wanted to get to the top of the mountain, and they ain't going to walk up there. So as they got up there to land, oh, let's see, an RPG hit the side of the helicopter. It's getting raked with the DHSK, whatever, Dishka. Basically a 50 caliber machine gun, just tearing the living snot out of the side of the helicopter. Blew out all the hydraulic lines. Now the floor is all covered with hydraulic fluid. And the guys are all up, and they're getting ready to jump out the back. And it's back and forth on the intercom with the guys in the back, the machine gunners, the crew chiefs and stuff, and they're like, well, what are you going to do? We're taking hits, and this is going on, and this is going on. The pilot's starting to struggle to hold the helicopter together. It's starting to vibrate very violently. And so the guy in the back, the crew chief, says, go, 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 and talking to the pilot. And this guy, Roberts, the air traffic controller, he thought he meant that meant go. And there seems to be some question about what happened, is as to where did he, because the helicopter started to move forward, but it jerked and lurched. And so the floor is all wet with sticky hydraulic fluid. So did he actually misinterpret what the crew chief said when he said, go, 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 or did he actually slip out the back of it? But the tailgate wasn't all the way down because the hydraulics, it was stuck at about a third of the way down. The rest of the steel stayed on the helicopter. The helicopter nosed over on the ridge, descended like 3,000 feet, and the pilot struggling to hold it. The crew chief in the back sees the hydraulics is at like zero, so they've got three big cans of hydraulic fluid, so he's pouring it in and pumping it up. The pilot's able to get a little bit of control, but it's basically coming out as fast as the crew chief can put the stuff in. They put it in, pump it up, and it gets a little control, and then it's back again, back and forth. And then they come down to this ridgeline, and he settles it in, and it's dead in the deal, man. So on this one little side spur line. So now there's this mass confusion because the SEAL team had gone back channel to back to Bagram and back to K2 to communicate with their SEAL commanders, and the actual commander on the ground from Delta, he's only hearing bits and pieces. And then all of a sudden, then Tampa with General Tommy Franks wants to get involved, and Mashira wants to get involved, and nobody actually really knows what's going on, because everybody other than the pilots and the crew and the SEAL teams on the downed helicopter, and they descended 3,000 feet and were more than 7 kilometers away from where this guy fell out the back of the helicopter. So then all of a sudden then they call in here, and it's just a big mess, and the whole point of what I'm going on here for this first 20 minutes of today's broadcast is it's the intelligence preparation of the battlefield. You know, there's these people that are well-trained, the Delta, Special Forces, the SEALs, the Rangers, and some people think that their training's going to pull them through, and they don't want to listen to people that have an idea of what's actually really going on, and they just want to go waltzing in there and making it up as they go along. And it cost a lot of people their lives. It got a couple other helicopters shot down, ventilated, more and more people wounded, people losing their arms and their legs and everything. The rescue force that had gone up here after Delta, the SEALs got back up in another helicopter, jumped off with four of them. I think two of them died. And then they had to jump off the ridgeline down in the snow to keep from getting the rest of them killed. And then they set up a team of Rangers, and they got their helicopter. It got hit with an RPG in one of the rear engines, and it's dead. And all of a sudden, the guys can't even get off the back of the helicopter because the 50 caliber rounds are just coming right through the skin of the helicopter like Swiss cheese. About four or five of them actually get off the back of the helicopter in different stages of disrepair. A couple of them were okay, but they're having to kind of fight their way uphill to these well-concealed, well-constructed bunkers. And then they had to have another team come in here to be dropped off, and it was just a big mess. But you know what I'm really saying, and it really exercises the point about this intelligence preparation of the battlefield. You may be trained well, but you need to go and get with the people on the ground that know the ground well and they know the conditions well, because if you think you're just going to waltz in here or something and try to take over because you're a so-and-so fill-in-the-blank, you ain't going to make it. You're going to get yourself in the world hurt, and then a lot of people are going to end up dying to try to come and rescue you. So I found it an interesting book because it ties right in with our insurgency, counterinsurgency, the intelligence preparation of the battlefield, the planning, the leadership, the training, the communications. It's just a whole one whole. This is a how not to do it type of operation, and what happens when, as they say, too many cooks spoil the broth, and you got a bunch of people in here that want to be in charge, too many chiefs and not enough Indians, and nobody wants to actually pay attention and leave it to the people on the ground or the people that are actually in charge. It just turned into a big mess, and it's That's what the deal is. So there, I had my say. I'd highly recommend the book. It's got quite a bit of interesting back. This guy that wrote it was a journalist for the Army Times or the Military Times or what. He was embedded, and he was able to interview a lot of these people, the CIA, the Delta, the Special Forces, the SEALs, the Rangers, and everybody on what they saw, the people in the Air Force in the C-130 that had shot up the convoy in the first place, and exactly what they saw, and about the Army Special Forces JSOC investigators and the looking at to who did what, when, and how all these things occurred, basically doing an after-action review on how we can keep some of this stuff from happening all over again. Yeah, big insight into special operations forces and how the things actually work, and not just some movie version of what. Now, when we talk about the guerrillas, because the specific techniques or tactics of guerrilla warfare are not, except in unimportant detail, to be learned from the text, and they relate always to the specific local situation and are extremely expedient. The guerrilla is, above all, an improviser, and the nature of his improvisation depends naturally on immediate and long-range objectives, the terrain, and relative strength of his force and those of the enemy, the material means at his disposal, and similar factors. Because since the guerrilla's numerical strength and arms are inferior to those of his enemy, or he'd not be a guerrilla, and since his most immediate concern is mere survival, the basis of all guerrilla tactics is, obviously, evasion. And successful evasion means the ability to avoid confrontation except at one's own choosing, yet always to be able to achieve the local superiority. Now, I don't know about you, but yeah, I guess they were able to call in the airstrikes and killed a bunch of these Al-Qaeda and Taliban people, but they certainly scored some real propaganda victories by shooting down a couple of helicopters, big helicopters. You know, the large rural towns can be garrisoned, but tiny hamlets cannot. Although there are many of them, only a few soldiers can be assigned to each, and to create such rural outposts is worse than useless, since each individual post can be easily overrun. Now, there's other consideration. The possession of populated areas will usually provide almost as much safety for the insurgents as would the remote areas in which they cannot be located or attacked. Like our lesson here about Afghanistan, they had little tiny villages down in the town, and the people down there were acting as a logistical break to bring the food up, and then the fighters would come down from their hills and their prepared positions and their caves and pick up the equipment and the food that they needed and move on back up to these honeycombed hillsides, natural caves and everything, and these bunkers. And so it was kind of interesting when we talk about the possession of the rural areas, the populated areas, because it's going to give safety for the insurgents. It depends on if it's a remote area in which they cannot be located or attacked. The danger of being isolated far from the populated areas has been demonstrated by the experience of the guerrillas in Malaya and the Philippines, because in both instances the military succeeded in isolating the insurgents, cutting them off from the source of their strength, which results that are fatal to the insurgency. Now, on the other hand, the possibility of fighting a successful guerrilla war on an island with little room for maneuver and no real wilderness sanctuary has been proven by Cypriot fighters of the EOKA, because when pressed, the small guerrilla bands commanded by Grievous in the hills of Cyprus would filter back into the towns, and the known fugitives who could not do so lived like foxes in earthen dugouts. Even if well policed, the large cities, a sympathetic population could protect active insurgents, and the draconian methods used by the French in Algeria virtually stamped out the FLN underground there, but only because the Muslims of the Kasbah had already separated racially and physically from the French population, and the soldiers, especially foreigners, could suppress urban rebellion by treating the entire metropolis as a city under wartime siege, controlling all movements, and ruthlessly killing the inhabitants of any quarter where resistance is offered. But gradually, an urban population can be starved and terrorized into submission, but those methods scarcely apply to the Civil War situation in which there is no sure way of knowing friend from foe. Now, with respect to the conditions that prevail in most of the Latin American republics, Che Guevara considered that a nucleus of 30 to 50 armed men is sufficient to initiate a guerrilla insurgency with good assurance of success. Now, the guerrilla nucleus initiates the conflict, if possible, on the edge of a wilderness sanctuary, in a thinly populated agricultural area with a marginal economy within easy striking distance of strategic targets, railway lines that can be cut, communications that can be disrupted, mining or industrial plants that can be sabotaged, small military or police posts from which arms can be seized. Now, at the same time, the urban insurrection of a hit-and-run rather than a sustained character is created by the revolutionary underground so as to give the insurgency a general national complexion for maximum propaganda effort. Now, it's not enough to rebel. The rebellion must be the object of the national attention, too shocking in its initial effect to be ignored by even a controlled press, or quickly explained away, as has been the case with many abortive provincial insurrections, by a government safe in the untroubled capital, far from the scene of battle. Now, regardless of the number of troops involved, the guerrillas will fight according to certain principles. They'll not seek to hold ground or contend with the stronger force, but only to cause and exhaust it and to inflict casualties on it without taking casualties in return. And the key to this kind of action is the well-placed ambush. Now, generally, writes Sun Tzu, he who occupies the field of battle first awaits his enemy is at ease. He who comes later to the fight and rushes into battle is wary. Now, the guerrilla will not give battle until the terrain favors him. Their effort will be to lure the enemy into situations in which the numbers are of little account because the way is too steep and the passage too narrow for more than a few to proceed at a time. And when the fighting begins, it will be on the ground of the rebel's own choosing, preferably from the commanding heights with dense cover and limited visibility where a few determined men can hold up the army. Kind of like what they did there in Anaconda. Now, ambushes will be prepared in such a manner that a small portion of the advancing military column, its vanguard, will be separated from the rest when the firing commences, and the fire of the main body of the guerrillas will be concentrated on the vanguard. Now, the superior mobility and small size of the guerrilla force are its main asset. The danger that they themselves may be encircled is usually more apparent than real, because night, as Guevara has noted, is the best ally of the guerrilla fighter. And although the Cubans use the phrase encirclement face to describe a look of someone who was frightened, Castro's guerrillas never suffered a single casualty through encirclement, and Guevara considers it no real problem for a guerrilla force. The guerrilla soldier always to have in mind that his source of supply of arms is the enemy and that, except in special circumstances, he ought not to engage in a battle that will not lead to the capture, that equipment. And the guerrilla vanguard is made a special target of the, or excuse me, the enemy vanguard is made a special target of the guerrilla fire for a sound psychological reason to induce fear, or at any rate, the excessive caution that it will paralyze the will and retard the free movement of the enemy. Because when the soldiers in the first rank invariably are killed, a few will wish to be in the vanguard, and without a vanguard, there's no movement. And a successful operation provides more arms, new guerrilla units can be organized, and new zones of operations open, and the guerrillas filtering through the enemy lines attack isolated army and police units in the village on the periphery of the free zone. And as the rebel strength grows, the army is confronted with a different dilemma. Having superior numbers and heavier arms, it will still be able to enter the rebel zones in strength, but only at the cost of some casualties and with no advantage, since the ground gain will have no strategic or economic value commensurate with the cost of occupying it. If the troops should remain in force, the guerrillas would simply transfer their operations to another zone because the army cannot be everywhere. Yet if the troops do not remain, the terrain is, in effect, ceded to the insurgents. Now, it's, of course, sharpened by political problem. Large chunks of the agricultural economy cannot be surrendered to the insurgents without political consequences. And those whose fortunes are affected, the traders, the absentee landowners, and the like, will be certain to put pressure on the government to do something. Now, in these types of circumstances, and considering that no army can occupy all of the national territory, considering that no army can occupy all the national territory, the logical natural course of the regime to gradually withdraw of troops when the countryside to the larger city areas, and the rural areas will thus be slowly and reluctantly surrendered to the insurgents. With expanded resources and manpower and material, the insurgents will continue to grow. And as it gains strength, the guerrilla bands will become guerrilla armies, and the larger villages will be captured, the railway bridges will be blown, and the highways cut. And one by one, the towns and then the cities will be isolated, and their vital supplies restricted, civilian transport reduced to a trickle. Now, the pattern is observable. It's already happened in the Western Hemisphere, and it's happening right now all over the world. Now, certainly it is not the only pattern the revolutionary warfare can follow. Is the United States itself immune? The complexity of modern urban heavily industrial societies makes them extremely vulnerable to wide-scale sabotage, a fact that has not gone unremarked by the extremists of the small but fanatical black nationalist movement in the United States. And the extent of their commitment may be judged by the February 1965 disclosure of a bizarre plot said it had been hatched by members of the Black Nationalist Revolutionary Action Movement to blow up the Statue of Liberty in New York, the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia, and the Washington Monument, because in an article in Esquire published just 4 months earlier, October of 64, entitled The Red Chinese American Negro, the Negro journalist William Worthy reported, with an eye on expected financial and material support from Asia and Africa, RAM has proclaimed the necessity to utilize the three basic principles of power held by Negroes, the power to stop the machinery of government, the power to hurt the economy, and the power to unleash violence. Now, the details were clearly spelled out elsewhere by a Negro leader has since been linked to RAM, writing in a monthly newsletter, The Crusader, Robert William, a former chapter president of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, who fled to Cuba after a racial incident in Monroe, North Carolina in 1961, pictured the coming black revolution in the United States in the following terms. When massive violence comes, the USA will become a bedlam of confusion and chaos. The factory, telephone, and radio workers will be afraid to report to their jobs. All transportation will grind to a complete standstill. Essential pipelines will be severed and blown up, and all manner of sabotage will occur. A clash will occur inside the armed forces at U.S. military bases around the world. Local revolutionaries will side with Afro-GIs. And then the new concept of revolution differs or defies military science and tactics, because the new concept is lightning campaigns conducted in highly sensitive urban communities, with the paralysis reaching the small communities and spreading to the farm areas. The old method of guerrilla warfare, as carried out from the hills and the countrysides, would be ineffective in a powerful country like the USA, and any such force would be wiped out in an hour. And the new concept is to huddle as close to the enemy as possible so as to neutralize his modern and fierce weapons. And the new concept dislocates the organs of harmony and order and reduces central power to the level of a helpless, sprawling octopus. And during the hours of day, sporadic rioting takes place and massive sniping. A night brings out all-out warfare and organized fighting and unlimited terror against the oppressor and his forces. And such a campaign will bring about an end to oppression and social justice in the United States as in less than 90 days. Now, Williams quotes from an interview which he claims to have had with one Mr. Lumumba, a pseudonym adopted in honor of the murdered Congolese premier, Patrice Lumumba, a purported underground leader with a plan for guerrilla warfare in the United States. Quote, "The United States is very vulnerable economically and physically. Black youth with the right orientation could stop this entire country. Small bands can damage the 8 major dams that supply most of the electricity. Electricity means mass communications. Gasoline can be poured into the sewer system in major urban areas and then ignited. This would burn out communications lines in an entire city. A lot would emerge from this chaos. Most likely guerrilla warfare. I don't think the entire white community will fight, but the entire black community will be fighting. We call our whites cream puffs. We feel that when TV stops, when the telephone no longer rings, their world will be almost come to an end. Like during a major air raid, they will stay in their house. They'll sit and wait for television to come on." End quote. And there's much exaggeration in all of this, and some pure ranting demagoguery, along with what may well be an honest misappraisal of the situation. As yet, there's no evidence that the Negro minority in the United States is prepared or disposed to violence, or indeed finds adequate cause. Yet the black nationalists have a point. Where the will to resist authority exists on a wide scale, the means can be found. Nor are urban industrial societies, however well policed, guerrilla-proof. Now, the guerrilla succeeds because he survives. He flourishes because his methods are progressive. With a pistol, a machete, or for that matter, a bow and arrow, he can capture a rifle. With 20 rifles, he can capture a machine gun. And with 20 rifles and a machine gun, he can capture a military patrol or destroy a convoy that carries 5 machine guns and 50,000 rounds of ammunition. With a dozen shovels and a few gallons of gasoline, he can destroy a tank. And with its weapons, he can shoot down an airplane or a helicopter that also carries weapons. And artillery is useless against him because it never catches up with him. A 500-pound aerial bomb will dig a crater 10 feet deep and 15 wide, but it will not disturb a guerrilla in a slit trench 10 yards away. And a dozen aircraft dropping napalm can splash liquid fire over 100 acres of woodland, but it will have no effect unless the guerrilla happens to be in that 100 acres out of the thousands through which they can roam. Now, once the war, the flea has reached the settled rural regions, even these limited means become ineffective because the aircraft cannot attack guerrillas without killing the civilians who support the government must win, and they all look alike from the air, and great faith was placed in the helicopter. They were of service in Sahara, but have failed to come up with expectations in the jungles in Vietnam, where the Viet Cong had learned to set successful traps for them, and crude casualties were heavy. And the United States Military Handbook on Irregular Warfare Techniques discuss various biological and chemical weapons that can be employed against the guerrillas. And these are recommended especially for situations in which guerrillas have mingled with an innocent civilian population that cannot or ought not to be killed. Now, the object of the so-called biologicals is to induce temporary incapacitation, viral diseases that will reduce the ability of the guerrillas to resist attack, or that infantry can rush into a target area and quickly kill or capture them without harming the non-combatants. And a device, so to speak, for separating the sheep from the goats. Now, various non-lethal gases carried, like the biologicals in artillery shells or aerial bombs or sprayed by low-flying planes or helicopters, have been designed for the same purpose, to stricken all within a given target area and so reduce resistance to infantrymen on their arrival without unnecessary bloodshed. Now, the concept is certainly humane and logical. Now, in practice, it may prove faulty. One of the three occasions in which the non-lethal gas, a mixture of vomiting agent and tear gas, of the type used to control rioters, was used in South Vietnam during the early 1965, and the practical results were nil. Twice the gas simply blew away without effect. Now, on the third occasion, it sickened a few residents of the target area, but the infantrymen who soon arrived found no guerrillas in the area. And the propaganda effect, on the other hand, were tremendous and adverse in the extreme. When Washington casually announced in March 65 that gas had been used in Vietnam, the political repercussions were heard around the world within 24 hours. The Asian press, especially the Japanese, forever scared by the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs, was loud in indignation. London and Paris made diplomatic inquiries, and much of the United States press itself sternly condemned the use of even the most harmless gas as a serious breach of all civilized conventions of warfare that could lead to who knew what barbarity. Now, considering the great effect of the Chinese changes in germ warfare against the Americans during the Korean War and the fresh outcry against gas, it is doubtful that the guerrillas will have much to fear from either gas or biological warfare in the near future, especially since the practical military remains unproven. Other weapons of modern military technology are more frightening. White phosphorus is invariably crippling, if not fatal, because it burns through to the bone. It will penetrate steel, and nothing extinguishes it but total immersion. A new 1,000-pound parcel bomb opens in the air to strew 100 anti-personnel bombs over as many yards, a weapon far more effective as against guerrillas than the concentrated detonation of a single high-explosive missile. Now, new amphibious gun carriers can penetrate the deepest swamps and marshes. Infrared and heat-sensitive sniper scopes can detect the guerrillas in the dark. A later model operates by magnifying the light of the stars. And the mobile radar units can spot infiltrators on the ground at 1,000 yards. And the silent weapons made the trained guerrilla hunter patrol even harder to detect than the guerrillas themselves. Yet, when all this is said and done, even the counter-revolutionary experts admit that technology alone can never defeat guerrillas. It can only make their task more difficult and dangerous, because the truck the crux of the struggle is the social and political climate. The flea survives by hopping and hiding. He prevails because he multiplies far faster than he can be caught and exterminated. The needs of the gorilla are few. A rifle, a blanket, a square of some impermeable material to shelter him from the rain, a knife, a compass, and stout boots, the minimum of ordinary camping equipment. Now, the personal qualifications are greater. Physically, the gorilla must be strong, with iron legs and sound lungs. Temperamentally, he must be cheerful, stoic, and he must be as hard, lead a hard life. But what is indispensable is ideological armor. Above all, the revolutionary activist must stand on solid moral ground if he is to be more than a political bandit. Now, one is led to believe, as in the case of the Viet Cong, for example, that the guerrillas dominate unprotected rural areas by threats and terror. It's a conventional thing for the country people to say when confronted by government soldiers to ask them why they had sheltered the guerrillas. Now, in general, it's not true. There are judicious uses of terror, no doubt, but no guerrilla can afford to use it against the people on whose support and confidence he depends for his life as well as for his political existence. People are quick to detect the difference between opportunism and dedication, and it is the latter that they respect and follow. And to be successful, the gorilla must be loved and admired. To attract followers, he must represent not merely success, but absolute virtue, so that his enemy will represent absolute evil. If the soldiers are idle, drunken, and licentious, the gorilla must be vigorous, sober, and moral. If enemies are to be disposed of, it must be for moral reasons. They must be traitors, murderers, rapists. The revolution must show that its justice is sure and swift, and by contrast, its enemies must be revealed as venal, weak, and vacillating. And the successful gorilla must be fair in his dealings, paying for the goods he takes, and respecting personal property and individual rights, even those of persons not partisan to his cause. In the realization that the society in which he works is an intricate and interlocking machinery, and that he requires all the support he can get, even where the war is at bottom a class struggle, and this is not always the case, class rivalries should be softened rather than sharpened, and subordinate to a transcendental national cause. And those in doubt, even in the adherents and servants of the regime, must be given clear moral choice. They must be told, in effect, it is still not too late to join forces with virtue and to have a share in the bright future, more secure and certain than the property or the position you value now. A revolutionary propaganda must be essentially true in order to be believed. This is a simple expedience. If it's not believed, people cannot be induced to act on it, and there will be no revolution. Guerrilla leaders do not inspire the spirit of sacrifice and revolution will that creates popular insurrection by promises alone or by guns alone. A high degree of selfless dedication and high purpose is required. Whether the primary cause of revolution is nationalism or social justice or the anticipation of material progress, the decision to fight and to sacrifice in a society and moral decision. An insurgency is thus a matter of manipulation. The insurgency is thus not a matter of manipulation, but of inspiration. Well, I see we've got about 5 minutes left in today's broadcast. Thanks for being with us today. My email address is altabib762@hotmail.com, and that's Alpha Lima Tango Hotel Alpha Bravo Echo Bravo 762@hotmail.com. Come a long way today. Talked about a a new book that I've picked up, Not a Good Day to Die, has to do with Operation Anaconda. It really ties in with our lesson about insurgency, counterinsurgency, the intelligence preparation of the battlefield. Quite interesting. And the unity of command, that seems to be one thing I've seen down here about, well, I can't tell me what to do, but who are you? Let's see, BorderlandBeat.com for October 2018, September 2018, second bloodiest month. In September, 456 homicides relate to the organized crime were committed, a figure that ranks as the second highest in the sexennium, only behind 1,532 victims registered last January, according to the monthly count in Millennio. During the 9 months of 2018, 11,850 murders have been reported, which results in a daily average of 43 violent deaths by the hands of drug traffickers and or organized crime, while in 2007 the average was 34. In absolute numbers, this year is 682 homicides to equal the annual number of executions in 2007, and in addition, only 808 crimes are missing, so that this year it became more violent since the millennial count began in 2007. Since 2015, there's a sustained trend in the increase in murders committed by for crime. 2015, 8,393 homicides were perpetrated, and for 2016, the figure reached 19,967 cases. 2017, 12,532 were counted, and is projected that by the year of 2018, 15,800 fatalities will be reported. But we can hear all about Saudi Arabia and Turkey and the missing Washington Post reporter, but we're not going to hear about BorderlandBeat.com, 5 October 2018, police shot in Hermosillo, Sonora, suspect in custody. Because the suspects were located and tracked through the C5 monitoring cameras in Sonora, municipal police officers arrested four suspects in the attack on an officer of the corporation who was shot dead on Friday morning when he left after completing the night shift in Hermosillo. On Friday morning at 8:30 a.m., Officer Jesus Omar Navarez was shot dead in some place that's hard to pronounce neighborhood south of the state capital. The authorities activated the red code, and through the video surveillance system of the C5, the agents managed to locate two trucks, a red Cheyenne pickup and another dark-colored Tahoe pickup, where they tackled the group of gunmen. Through the cameras, the suspects were tracked to the north of Hermosillo on Boulevard Progreso. There was an armed confrontation where the mixed operative managed to arrest four suspects in possession of weapons and tactical equipment. I don't know if I want to do this last one. I got one here, and it's kind of a long, the freedom of the CJNG. I printed out three pages of it. It says here it's long. Direct family members and politicians close to Nemesio Osguera El Mencho have been released during the last year. Among them is wife and in-law, a son-in-law. Authorities boasted the capture of more than 30 cartel members, 50 of them ringleaders, during the same period. However, even with the reward increasing 30 million pesos, the CJNG leader cannot be located. Well, I see we're kind of almost, we've got about 2-3 minutes left here on today's broadcast. We went a long way today, covered a little bit more of about our war on the flea and about Sun Tzu and talked about Cuba and General Grievous and Che Guevara. As always, we send this broadcast out to Lily, Grace, Antoinette. My email address is altabib762@hotmail.com, and that's Alpha Lima Tango, Hotel, Alpha, Bravo, Echo, Bravo, 762@hotmail.com. Thanks for taking the time to tune in today. Please tell your friends about Liberty Tree Radio. And remember, we're coming up here on the end of this year's schedule, and usually about 6 months out, try to start raising funds for some next year's bill. So if you can please go to libertytreeradio.4mg.com. All the contact information is there, and really appreciate it if you'd help keep Liberty Tree Radio on the air. Freedom isn't free, and you shouldn't be able to afford a dollar a year. I'll see you. You guys take care of yourselves.
There's a woman on my lap and she's drinking champagne. Have white skin, got a satin eyes. I'm looking up into the sapphire sky. A well-dressed man waiting on the last plane. Standing in the gallows with my head in the